Hello, you're listening to Spoiler.
Build.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray!
So, I am the podcast's perfect host. See, I'm foreshadowing the podcast already. Richard Nicholas, hello, hello, hello. And with me is my co-hosts, Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
Abigail Bain.
Hello.
And Anthony Evans.
Hi.
So, guys, this week's film was The Perfect Host. You see, it makes sense now why I did the different... You get it.
It all falls into place.
That's right. I'm slick. That's all I'm saying. This week's film was The Perfect Host. It was your pick, Anthony. So maybe you should give some of the details of the film for the listener to not have to look on IMDb.
Oh, well, okay, then I will. The Perfect Host, written and directed by Nick Tomney and released in 2010, is a horror, psychological thriller, mystery, heist film, I guess. I'm sure I've left out a few genres there. Anyway, it stars Clayne Crawford as injured bank robber John Taylor, who cons his way into the home of Warwick Wilson, played by David Hyde Pierce, to hide at. However, John has just stumbled into a dinner party that is not all what it seems. The Perfect Host also stars Nathaniel Parker, Megan Perry, and Tyrese Allen.
It is a difficult genre to nail down. I would settle in just thriller, because in a way, saying horror kind of spoils, like, the, you don't really get into the horror of it at first, and then it just becomes something else at the end. So I couldn't call it any of those genres. Comfortably. What would you guys put it in, Jamie or Abby? What genre is this film?
I would just use the catch-all of, like, black comedy, because it was pretty funny in a really bleak way.
See, comedy didn't even consider that as an option, and yet it obviously is. Drama?
Yeah, I think I'd have to go with a black comedy as well, because... Yeah. As soon as you spend a certain proportion of a film laughing, you have to call it a comedy, even if that's not what it was intended to be.
Or a very terrible, like, action movie. Those sometimes aren't comedies, but can be laughed all the way through. But that's cinema for you, isn't it? It's weird. So, Anthony, why did you suggest this film to us?
Well, I'd seen it before, and it's certainly a weird one, which I thought would go down well. With film being crew.
With weird people?
That's what we are. Admitted.
Yep. What do you say, anyway, talking horse? Sorry, that's not... Carry on.
And yeah, it got my attention because I've never really seen David Hyde Pierce in anything else other than Frasier. And to be fair, he was kind of like the funny one on Frasier. So it's kind of weird that you've never seen anything else from him. So then I found this, and I was surprised.
Yeah, I have seen another film with him in, and I've also seen some stand-up comedy he did at Montreal, one of the festival like highlight shows. And he's quite funny, like a funny guy, so I was on board as soon as you suggested it. And the trailer made it seem like a very unusual kind of, what's this going to be? And it looked like it was going to be sort of American Psycho... with just some other premise, I don't know, just slightly different campy, not campy, just a slightly different tone to American Psycho. That's
I think it does share a lot in common. Like, it's not quite as streamlined as American Psycho in its point, but it's tonally quite similar. Like, this is almost something you could imagine being an episode from Patrick Bateman's life. Throwing this kind of dinner party is something you could imagine him doing.
Yeah. But it isn't fair to compare it to that exactly, because it's a lot different and a lot more and a lot, you know, it's just a lot. And it has very much three acts to it, I would say.
Yeah.
And I think the first thing I would say, before we spoil any of it, because it is spoiler-filled film conversation, hooray, and if you haven't seen it and you're listening to us, do check it out, because the stuff we say will spoil it in a kind of it's nice to get, it would be nice to see it without knowing what's going to happen, because that's how I came to it, and it was good for being unexpected at various points. You know, would you guys agree?
Yes and no.
You think it can be talked about and you could still...
No, I agree that it's more interesting to go into it blind. I just think some of the I don't want to call them twists because that's a bit dismissive, but some of the directions the story takes are a bit...
questionable.
Yeah. Misguided, maybe.
Well, we'll get into it, but I'm just saying it is one to... It has got twists that are important. It's funny anyway. Even with the spoilers, it's kind of still going to be amusing if you liked it. Maybe you guys didn't. I haven't chatted to you about it yet. So, Abby, what were you expecting about this film?
Well, I knew absolutely nothing about the film.
And therefore...
and therefore, I was just told to watch it and did. Absolutely no expectations at all.
What does the title... The Perfect Horse conjured you. You knew it was called that.
The Perfect Horse? I expected some kind of dinner party, I guess, which we got.
Could have been about ghosts, couldn't it? Because you get hosts in a sort of seance.
Yes.
But you didn't think along those lines. It's good, because it's not about ghosts. Jamie, yourself.
Yeah. I remember seeing the trailer for this, like, back when it came out in 2010, and then thinking that I want to see that, because I think everybody likes David Hyde Pierce. Like, I can't imagine anyone really, like, he's very inoffensive. But
you'll either be neutral or like him.
I don't know if you can generalize that much. I mean,
I am generalizing. No, I think David Hyde Pierce is pretty inoffensive. Like, you either like him or you're neutral on him. But he's very good at what he does. He's never, like, apart from Frasier, he's never been particularly huge, as far as I'm aware. Like, that's
very low-key, yeah.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people know him from. And he's not one of those, like, he's not a celebrity, he doesn't court fame.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to see him... Like, because the trailer, if I remember right, does, like, kind of reveal that he's a sinister character.
Yeah, it does. It sort of hints at it without being explicit, yeah.
But it, like, he's impressed. It's impressive enough in the trailer that it made me really want to see the whole film, just to see him, just to see basically Niles Crane acting sinister.
Yeah, because
that's so unfamiliar.
What if Niles Crane was a potential Arkham Asylum inmate? I know what you mean. Because it is in the same ballpark or wine club as Niles Crane, the character. But it does step away from that with the plot itself. But also the character isn't exactly the same, obviously. But he is that kind of dinner party throwing... chit-chat and wine kind of guy, isn't he?
It's almost as if, you know, what would have happened to Niles had the rest of his family died in a car crash and he'd been rejected by what's-her-name.
Or if Frasier was cancelled and he wanted to carry on just pretending he was making it. okay, so the film then, guys. What's the setup at the start? Who's our main guy we get shown?
Well, it starts off with us following, John Taylor, as he is seemingly running away from something. We're not quite sure what it is at first, and he, like, ditches a disguise and gets in a car and drives away.
Not a very good disguise, was it? It was just sort of a hat with a wig under it and glasses.
It's a movie disguise, that's all you need.
To rob a movie bank, that's right. Which is what we find out he is. Right, so limping bank robber on the run, exciting movie stuff.
So yeah, we're not quite sure what's going on with him. You know, I think it's clear that he's on the run from something.
Disposing of vehicles and hiding things in the rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah. So then he just kind of tries to con his way into a couple of people's houses. First of all, by pretending he's a Jehovah's Witness. But then he's caught out by their crafty logicness of the Jehovah's Witnesses. and then stumbles upon David Hyde Pierce's place, and then using a postcard, seemingly from a friend in Australia, gets his way into the house.
You make it sound like he used the postcard as like a credit card to swipe in like a thing or something. But he puts on a sort of con-style ruse to get in, doesn't he?
Yeah, he pretends to know the friend who has written the postcard to Warwick.
Yeah.
And says, yeah, she told me about you. She said, you know, we'd really get along. And he pretends that he's been mugged and plays the sympathy card. And then...
Well, he has been mugged in reality. We did kind of gloss over a bit.
Well,
he actually turns up in a convenience store to get something to... He's got like a cut on his
disinfectant
foot.
Disinfectant for his wounded foot.
And he's in a convenience store that gets robbed. So, in fairness, that bit is true. And they have a kind of... There's some stick with a Jehovah's Witness, as you mentioned, Anthony, which was kind of funny. And it was good that he kind of failed at the first to con people. He doesn't just pick the first person to con, and then that's the movie. We were talking about how he was conning our man, though, right?
But yeah, he just kind of works his way into the house whilst Warwick is preparing for a dinner party and just kind of bluffs his way until, I don't know, it's safe to leave, I guess.
Well, this is, even though not much is happening yet, it's probably, I would actually say it's probably, like, the tensest scene of the film, despite what happens later when things get more severe, because I hate seeing people try and blag stuff when I know different. And, seeing him, and because of things that happened later, it becomes clear that Warwick knows right from the start and keeps poking at it.
I got that impression anyway. Like, even if I hadn't seen the trailer, the way he behaves is just sort of like someone trying to lead you into, like, flaws. You know, he's the word perfect host is correct, because he's being the perfect person for the con, because he's leading the guy. Like, he's accepting everything the guy says while simultaneously challenging him to come up with more details so that he can kind of call him on it. But it's not obvious if he knows at that point. Like, Warwick is holding his cards to his chest but going along with it. And at that point, I thought it was just going to be about a guy trying to lie his way through a whole dinner party and not get caught out till, like, later on. Do you know what I mean?
Which, in itself, is a pretty good premise.
Did anyone else get that feeling, like it wasn't just going to be... Like, it goes off from that, because he gets outed at about the end of Act 1, really, and it kind of takes on a different point. But it is really tense and awkward, as you say. Like, Sorry, go on now.
I figured that, like, it could have been a hostage thing, but the opposite way that it actually did turn out. Like, Warwick would twig, but it would be too late, so in the house, and then he'd... I can't remember the character's name.
John? Or the other ones?
John Taylor, yeah. John Taylor would get the upper hand and be trying to deal with the situation.
Yeah, I mean, it could have just been a very straightforward, kind of awkward dinner party turned hostage situation. That was the kind of vibe that you got. I mean, it's hard, you know, some of it is telegraphed in the trailer, it's going to escalate, but you don't know what it's going to do yet, and it is just playing on people trying to get away with a lie, and it's kind of could be too cringy for some people, I think.
Yeah, I had a hard time with it, not because it was done badly, but because it's so embarrassing to watch people potentially embarrass themselves. And it keeps escalating. Like, he calls the airport about his luggage that he's lied about and isn't there, and asks him questions about Julia and all. Oh God. But you were saying about the film having a very clear three-act structure.
I think so.
Yeah, and this is clearly, you know, the stuff that happens in the first act. Each act has a different version of Warwick, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, each act is David Hyde Pierce playing the same character, but in different ways. So in this act, he's very
obliging,
welcoming and accommodating. Yeah. Yeah, and he's very polite. And he's a little bit... He's very fussy. He's like a human C-3PO.
He's like a sort of toff and likes making chit-chat, but is very OCD about cleaning and being neat and tidy. And
he comes across as very weak.
Yeah.
There's no, like, masculinity or strength about him.
Yeah. And you just, there's a lot of work done in the first act of trying to get you to predict what you think is going to happen, because you should be constantly trying to think, what's going on here? When is it going to turn, and when's it going to go nasty? And it's just the way that you don't really know at any point if Warwick is onto him, just because he gives him enough to make you think, oh, he doesn't realise, and then he also does enough making the guy justify himself to make you go, oh, he knows.
Yeah.
Mm. But what was the turning point where he goes from having a guest who's lying to him to having a psychotic bank robber turn on him?
It's the... John hears the report on the radio of the robbery, and they're having a dinner party conversation because he convinced him to stay, even though he keeps trying to escape. And then he tells Warwick to shut up. Like, he shouts at him to shut up, which is the first, like, sign of violence in him. And then when he hears over the radio, what he hears has, like, twigs with him that...
He's been betrayed by the woman he was in collusion with.
He was robbing the bank in cahoots with his girlfriend who worked there because she was sick and he wanted the money to pay for whatever operation he thought she needed. And now he's found out that she set him up through the radio report. And that's when he snaps and he gets violent with Warwick.
Well, he kind of wants to hear it and needs to hear it because he's concerned. And he's trying to hide out in this guy's house, and he needs to know how much danger he's in. And all that backstory we kind of get told throughout the film, it's not all there at the start. We just know he's concerned because it's a radio report about him. And he, in a way, it's kind of like, dude, you're getting away with it. You could have just said, you know, you didn't need to ruin it then and slam down the postcard and be like, look, shut up, I'm conning you, and now you're my hostage, and do as I say. Little
man. I think a lot of it is he snaps because he's been betrayed.
And badgered by chit-chat. And been forced to lie more. Nothing makes me crack more than people trying to idly chat about the best kind of cheese or whatever. Not that they talk about cheese. But that's the kind of dinner party conversation that might drive you slightly mad.
And the whole time as well, he's been drinking wine.
Yes. The infamous red wine. But yeah, basically, the dinner guests that are expected are coming, and now John wants them to not come and spoil everything, and he wants to... he kind of wants to stay in the guy's house for a bit. I don't really understand what his plan is why is it at his advantage to stay in some randomer's house, you know?
I don't think he intended to stay there very long, but he did need to buy himself a little bit of time to work out what to do next.
Yeah, because he's kind of at a loss now, because he's been abandoned by... the person he was working with.
And so he forces Warwick to phone up his dinner guests and cancel so they don't turn up and kind of find him holding a knife to Warwick's throat or whatever.
Mm.
Plus, he has a bad foot to attend to. I mean, it must be horrible being a bank robber with a bad foot in someone's stranger's house. Tough times. You've not been there, guys?
Well, I have, but I don't want to say because I might get in trouble.
Did you get blood on someone's floor, Jamie?
No, I was implying that I robbed a bank once.
Yeah, I know, but in... Oh, never mind. Anyway, this is the pivotal Act 2, then, where... Is this Act 2, or is it when... No.
No, yeah, I would say, because this is when John collapses, because the wine has been drugged.
That's right. So this wine that Warwick has been giving him is seemingly spiked in some way, because John starts to... feel a bit weak and passes out on the floor.
Mm.
Then what?
Then he wakes up and stuff gets interesting.
Yeah, he wakes up tied to a chair at the dinner table. And he discovers that Warwick has some invisible dinner guest.
You know, we've all been there. We've all had dreams of being on Come Dine With Me and sat around pretending to have a dinner party and making small talk with people who aren't there. Right? I mean, good practice for when Come Dine With Me finally call back and you get to be on the show.
If there was at least one episode of Come Dine With Me where it was someone with imaginary dinner guests. That would be everybody's favourite episode.
It would.
I don't know how you'd visually show that. Well, I guess this explains how you'd visually show imaginary dinner guests.
Well, you wouldn't. You'd just show that guy talking to himself.
Yeah, and it would be... all the blanks would be filled in by the sarky voiceover guy. It would be amazing.
Warwick thinks he has dinner guests, but they're all fictional. He's going to burn this duck and then serve it up. Huh, I don't think that's the right way to use oven gloves. Warwick. Janine doesn't look very pleased with the tartar sauce. She'll be cleaning off her dress tonight, you know, like, just... It would be good. You're right. I kind of do want to see an imaginary friends come dine with me. But we kind of do, because the way they convey it anyway in the film is they're not there, and it's not like a hidden for ages, because it doesn't do like a Fight Club thing, spoilers, where they reveal at the end that there's an imaginary character that we've seen all the way through. It literally shows us he's talking to people who aren't there. Then it shows us presumably what he sees, which is four dinner guests. Does someone want to describe his dinner guests that he creates?
They're quite, I very rarely use the phrase well-to-do, but I'm going to use it today. There's one that works at the district attorney's office, another one is
an artist. Yeah.
So they're quite, I don't know the word for it.
Effete. They're quite, they're all very obviously educated. Very kind of classy.
Hoity-toity upper crust dinner guests that you'd expect Warwick to hang out with.
They've got names like Rupert and Julian. Simone.
Yeah. And they don't have much to their characters, really. I mean, they make chit-chat with Warwick. And, well, pretty much. And there are more guests, like, turn up for a party later, but they're the kind of key four that he seems to imagine at his dinner table eating food with.
Yeah, those are the ones that are like his friends, like his core group. But I like the fact that it doesn't do the Fight Club thing, where it goes, they were imaginary all the time. I like the fact that it tells you outright, right from the beginning.
You wouldn't,
this guy's nuts.
Yeah, you wouldn't enjoy any of the jokes if you thought they were really there. Like, the times he chats to them and talks or dances with them, that wouldn't be a joke then, would it? It just wouldn't be funny for ages.
Very early on... one of my favourite moments in the film when he goes from plate to plate eating their food very quickly.
And they cut to his point of view and he can see the person, but he's still eating their food.
It was
so
bizarre.
He's mental even in his own imaginary world.
It was just the stare on his face as he guzzles up the really nice looking duck and noodles and stuff. Just absolutely like, wow. Like, it was just surprising and funny, and it's just like if a child has an invisible friend and they insist on the parents making an extra meal for the invisible imaginary friend, and then obviously they have to eat the other food, otherwise they're going to be in trouble, so they just scoff it down when no one's looking. But then it's good that he doesn't waste food, right?
Yeah.
That's a positive. Sure.
You'd think he'd be fatter.
Depends how many times a week he makes this dinner party. Maybe it's enough to see him through for a while. five plates of duck.
One of the things I wanted to talk about with this, actually, was how this is a film about performance quite a lot of the time. Because you touched on it earlier, Jimmy, when you said that he's a different person in each act. And how the whole movie is about him pretending to be various people at various points.
Yeah, but in the transition from the first act to the second act... he's still the same character as opposed to what happens in the third act.
Mm.
But it is like the Warwick from the first act unhinged. Like it's taken to an extreme.
Mm.
Yeah, he suddenly takes on a more threatening kind of intimidating personality.
It's a different aspect of the same character.
Anthony, at what point did you sort of get on board with this film and think, this is going to be one to recommend to people?
What's a specific point?
Like, was it at this stage where you're like, oh, this is going to be quite the journey? Or was it, did it take the whole thing for you to kind of go, I have to, you know, put this to other people?
Yeah, well, it had to, I'd say the whole second act. Just, yeah. Like, all the little things that happened. Like, I just remember, like, him coming in one scene and just giving, like, a slightly unconscious John just a massive slap to wake up.
Yeah, and that's the moments where it's a bit like American Psycho. Like, it takes on the sort of, the bit where he's talking to a guy in a chair and talking about Phil Collins, but also being sort of awkward and serial killer-y, you know?
Yeah, but he's brutal towards John as well.
Well, he's got him tied up and is forcing him to take part in the dinner party that is usually imaginary. It seems there's a lot more to Warwick's character. There seems to be an implied, how does he do this always with a hostage, or does he just have these imaginary ones regularly? Because at one point, when John isn't going along with this pretend dinner party, he brings out the kind of serial killer book of collage.
Yeah. It's just a kind of, like, weird child scrapbook of people tied to chairs.
With little drawings on them and stuff, and like lots of colourful collage.
I couldn't work out at this point whether I was being dense or not. But like, the people in the book that he'd photographed, were they actual victims? Because of things that are revealed later.
That's the thing with this film, like, the whole reveal of the third act and like, just big changes in direction from the film just leave you with lots of questions.
Yeah, I think that's I can come on to it more later, but I think that's like the weakness of the film is the sudden change in direction.
Mm.
Where David Hyde Pierce pulls it off very well, but the plot doesn't.
Yeah.
It's kind of
suddenly you start going, wait, what?
It has a really good premise going, and it should normally escalate to some kind of serial killer reveal. Maybe the guy gets away, maybe Guy Pearce has some darker secret or some extra hidden thing or, like, some bigger twist. But the third act just goes, right, we've got some other ideas we want to try out. Let's ditch this a little bit. And basically what we're alluding to is the presumption from the serial killer book is he's had victims tied up, and then through various times through the night, Polaroids taken of them, and they seemingly have been partly tortured. And there's just a guy who has a slit throat at the end, and that's like at a certain time. And he's sort of saying to this guy, look, I do this to people, and you are the victim tonight, and I draw my friends in the scrapbook with you and think it's a dinner party, but look, really, I'm going to kill you.
The other thing as well was when they said, haven't you got that film of the last dinner party? And it was just Warwick cutting himself, and it was like, well, this isn't anything like this dinner party. You're also alone.
It's Warwick supposedly cutting himself.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the thing. One of the things that twigs you into him not potentially being a serial killer is there is this moment of, why don't you show him the film like you say, Ab? And he shows him like this, like, Super 8 film of just a black and white like video of Warwick slicing himself, and I think you see his chest at some point, and he's not scarred in any way, and you kind of go, if you're quick enough, you might put something together that's not something not right, and thinking that he's maybe just faking him out to teach him a lesson about lying to strangers and conning them, you know what I mean? But it's quite an elaborate, but then he couldn't possibly have known the guy was coming, so it kind of creates inconsistencies once it reveals more that the guy is actually not a serial killer, but actually deluded, insane con guy himself?
There's a strange thing going on with Warwick's character that I almost admire the film for not making it explicitly clear, but he has a lot of, like, he has those movie masks.
Yeah.
He has a Super 8 recorder that he uses to make films. He has a Polaroid camera, and He has a lot of fake stuff.
Yeah.
And it was almost, I thought it was going to go that it's revealed he's like a special effects guy.
Like FX, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. No, that would have made that a lot more interesting. But, like someone who works in the movies and does special effects, and that's he's just come unhinged.
Or that he was just messing with the guy. Like, he could have just been someone who knew that the guy was a liar and instantly wanted, I'm going to mess with him now and pretend.
Well, that was where I also thought it was going to go in the third act, when the big reveal happens, is that the whole thing had been a setup just to mess with him or something.
It could have had more pedestrian explanations than the one they go with in the third act.
Yeah.
The whole second act is just, let's have fun watching David Hyde Pierce be a crazy guy, dance on tables. Like, there's a bit where the song in a car wash, what was the car wash song?
Yeah, I think it's just car wash.
Yeah, the disco song is playing, and him and his imaginary guests are all dancing. And every now and again it cuts to Hyde Pierce on his own dancing, and then... It's just, and then John's tied up sitting there watching him, looking a bit bruised and being like, what is going on?
Yeah. And that is the party that goes on.
After the dinner party kicks off a bit and there's more people there that are being imagined.
Yeah, a bunch of imaginary people turn up. And that's when it gets, really entertaining, because it is just David Hyde Pierce going nuts for, something like 40 minutes.
And then occasionally making John drink more of this spiked wine.
Yeah.
And sit there putting up, and trying to engage with him as well. He chats to him occasionally as well as his guests. Like, one of the best bits was David Hyde Pierce is all flirting with one of his imaginary guests for ages. And it's making other people in the party slightly awkward. And obviously John. But he's just carrying on and going on with it. Were there other little bits that, this is a good time maybe to ask you guys what were your kind of favourite Warwick moments within the insane dinner party thing? Anthony?
I think you kind of mentioned them all. I mean, the most striking one is definitely the dance scene.
Yeah.
A little later on, just before, the third act comes in, there is a scene where he is pretending to have sex with someone over a sink.
Yeah.
Which is...
You know what I really love about that? This film had a little bit of class and didn't show you who it was.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't actually reveal who he was having sex with. It just showed him having sex with nothing in front of the sink.
And making some dreadful, MacGruber-style noises.
Although I think one of the more memorable bits was when you have John drugged in a pool and just kind of hanging there. I just remember watching it and going, oh, that's actually quite a bit freaky.
And it was when, his neighbour comes over. Who is the... She's the Jehovah's Witness, isn't she?
Yeah, that John previously tried to con into the house. And she was like, no, Jehovah's don't have crosses. So when I asked you about a cross, you should have been like, what? And I mentioned Christmas snootily, and ha ha ha, I tricked you. You didn't know enough about Jehovah's Witnesses. You can't come in.
Yeah.
That bit.
That's happened to me a lot.
Well, you reverse Jehovah's Witnesses, where you knock on them and they don't let you in.
Yeah.
It's kind of ironic.
Because I don't know enough.
That's how Jehovah's work. They come to your house and demand you talk about Jesus, but when you come to them, they're not having it.
No.
Anyway, you're saying...
Yeah, well, he puts the mask, the creature from the Black Lagoon mask, on John to disguise him.
Which is an option of several masks.
See, this is another thing that seemed like it was hinting towards something. And I don't know if it is just saying, if it is just a deliberately on-the-nose thing about this guy, lives in an imaginary world, which is why he's got a lot of, almost movie stuff and special effects equipment.
Or just has other delusions other times. Maybe it's not always a dinner party. Maybe there's some other scenarios, he thinks he's just in Funhouse one week with all of his imaginary friends, or on a pirate ship or something.
That's a potential answer, actually, because there is the fact that, later on in the film, after the reveal, you see the same friends dressed as cops.
Mm.
Mm.
They've taken on a different guise now, but they're still the same people.
Yeah, maybe to explain the catalogue of people who are victims in his little collage book. I don't know, a postman turned up late with some mail and asked to come in. And, I don't know, Hyde Pierce... Oh, sorry. And Warwick was just dressed as a pirate. And he's like, just come in. actually, can you take an eye patch? Sure, I have to go, but... And then he just kind of, like, do you want some wine? And it's like, oh, yeah, that's great, I'm just finishing. Like, and then he's in the pirate ship story, and then suddenly he's being covered in fake bruises and cuts and stuff, and he just adds him to the book and then lets him go all freaked out. Like,
That's another thing as well that we forgot to mention, is there's a point where John wakes up. I think it might come after when the party's winding down, actually. And he's got cuts all over his face, and Warwick shows him, and he asks, you know, what did you do to me?
Yeah.
And it's not revealed there. Like, you go with the assumption that he did cut him while he was unconscious.
Yeah, but it's kind of like, why? Like, and the guy's already in pain, because he has been hit, and he has got a bad foot. So
yeah, plus he's maybe drugged up anyway, so he has no idea whether he just can't feel it.
Yeah, so that you can. So I didn't quite buy that you wouldn't realise your own fake cuts weren't real, but he is drugged and he is all, yeah, like, it kind of, you can get away with the fact that he didn't realise the cuts on his face aren't real.
Yeah.
But it is a bit, what? You know. But anyway, we were talking about the pool thing and the nosy neighbour, and I like the way it gets suddenly really tense there, because now Warwick has to blag his way into saying his friend's drunk. And the fact that he did was just in the pool with the little bait, like one of those armbands, that's what they're called. And then the little ring just being held up in the water, and then he's like out of the pool and in a mask and trying to talk through the drugged mouth, through the drugged thing, and just is mumbling like a drunk. It's plausible, but really creates quite a tense scene. Do you guys agree?
Yeah, yes. It made me feel really weird, because it felt a little bit too close to the bone for me, where there will be situations where people are trying to call out for help, can't, and people just think they're drunk.
And when he tries to take the mask off, and he's fumbling like a drunk, can't quite get coordination, so it's just cuspy.
It hit close to home for me, because...
You're always drunk?
A lot of the time. I've been that drunk before. I can barely do anything and someone's had to carry me. And it is a kind of thing where, wow, you realise afterwards, anyone could have done anything. And I would have no idea.
Yeah.
But he does get away with it. And the neighbour is kind of shooed away but suspicious. And they go in, and what I quite liked is the moment where she's gone, and Warwick's got, like, helping him back into the house and pretending he's drunk. As soon as she's gone, he just throws him on the floor instantly. but anyone, can anyone explain, what was the next part of this story?
They bust out the chessboard, which is a bit out of nowhere.
Gotta have a drunken wager game of chess.
Yeah, it seemed like a really cliched moment when it happened.
Especially because it came out of nowhere. It was very suddenly, we're going to play chess? Oh, by the way, I'm really good at chess.
Yeah, and it started to show him in flashbacks teaching his girlfriend chess, but it had not come up at any point.
No.
And never is he portrayed as the kind of guy who plays chess very well.
Well, yeah, Anthony, you say it's cliched because, you know, it does happen in other... Like, Seventh Seal is basically chess with death. Like... as a bizarre metaphor, and it's like the challenge bit of a fantasy movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just you know, the end where you have a film with, like, prisoners or people trying to, like, outwit each other. They always have that, like, the thing at the end where, like, the victim always finds a way to outsmart them somehow.
Yeah, it's not always chess, is it?
It felt like one of those moments, like, oh, we're going down this route again, are we?
It was just a hack. It was just a hack thing to do out of a really cliched playbook of things you can do to outsmart someone who's calling you.
It doesn't end up making a lot of sense because John wins and wins his freedom, and then ends up getting put back in peril and doesn't escape anyway.
And it does the whole weird Back to the Future calling him chicken thing, where he's getting to leave, and then Warwick's like. You're nothing. What do you mean I'm nothing? You're the one imagining people. You're nothing, John. What? That makes me want to kill you, even though I want to flee very far away from you. I'm still angry enough to be a git and try and kill you.
And that's another thing, like, another one of the fake things. He takes the shorter of the samurai swords off the wall and stabs Warwick, and then it's revealed that it's a retractable blade.
Do you think that, do you think there wasn't a retractable samurai sword then, do you?
No, it just, like...
You just think he picked... Like, did he pick the one that was retractable? Like,
yeah.
Literally all retractable? Or did Warwick know he'd go for the easiest one to unclasp?
It was a bit,
you know... He could have just strangled you.
Yeah, like, how did he know he was gonna... Like... And the reveal of him being a special effects guy never came.
No.
Like, it would have made perfect sense, because he has props all over his house. And then, like... The fact that he stabs him, you know, with every intent to kill him until he finds out it's a retractable blade. So Warwick knocks him out and then puts him in the bin outside. Like, that's... And
it's just to psych us out, isn't it? It's just there to go, he slit his throat and killed him, oh no! Although it's like, well, they're gonna, you know... Like, I kind of knew he'd get up and it would be fake, but...
Yeah.
I think most people might be left going, what?
It seems a bit too, not stupid exactly for Warwick, but he's an intelligent man, and he wouldn't kill someone, then dump him in his own bin.
Yeah, and this is in full view of the neighbours.
Yeah.
And he's done this before, presumably? Either that, or he's actually killed people, and this time he didn't, because he lost the chess.
This is also, for me now, this is where it starts to fall apart, is where it's, this is the reveal that... Warwick is a cop, because the other cop...
But Jimmy, does it get worse, or is it the best amping up of the story you could do?
But he's not just any cop. He is the cop who is investigating the crime that John has committed.
Who has happened to turn up at his house for his imaginary dinner party.
Yeah, that he has regularly, and sends postcards to himself so that he can... I mean, there's no other situation where anyone else would read the guy's postcards and come in. So it's a really weird and contrite linking of the story, isn't it?
Yeah, this is where it falls apart, I think, because there are so many coincidences.
Mm.
And it is quite ludicrous.
Yeah, like, if it had just been guy on the run... cons his way into the house of a guy having a dinner party. Turns out the guy's mental, and now the guy on the run has to escape.
Yeah.
Fine. That itself would have been great. But this whole bit now, and it's not to fault David Hyde Pierce, because it's really interesting here. His performance completely changes suddenly.
Well, he puts on a slightly derpy, rough guy type.
No, because his attitude changes. Like, suddenly he's all, like, hunched over and, like, a bit grubby and, like, he's talking about...
He starts to become, like, Harvey Keitel from, like, The Bad Lieutenant, sort of.
Whereas previously he's kind of been Roger from American Dad. He even walks a bit like Roger from American Dad and sloshes back the wine the same way.
The walk was weird. I'm not really sure what was going on. But then you think, oh, so he's not nuts. This whole thing is a setup. But then it turns out, no, he is still nuts.
He's just also a cop now.
Yeah.
It could have, like, even tried to link in the cop thing to he knew he was the guy on the run because he'd had the report. So he messed with him for the evening and then just took him to jail. Or maybe tried to take him to jail but got outsmarted. Do you know what I mean? It could have... Simplify, and it might have come together in a slightly less ludicrous way.
From here on, it just becomes so convoluted.
Or brilliant. Amazing.
I'll be honest, I didn't have a clue what was going on after that point. Like, I was sitting there thinking, so, what? And I kept waiting for something, and nothing ever happened.
Well, just during the whole event, we've had flashbacks of John's life to... It's initially just to give some context to what he's done. We don't know he's done a robbery. We don't know why. He has a very... his girlfriend is seemingly ill, and she needs hospital treatment. So we're starting to build sympathy for him. And now that his problem is kind of worsening in the fact he's got a maniac who's tied him up, it's getting sympathy on side for John. And we're getting shown a couple of random cops, detectives, investigating the robbery as well. And then it comes to fruition at the end, doesn't it?
They are two of the worst cops I've ever seen, just because they take the longest amount of time to do a really simple thing. Let's look at the video. Yeah, all right. Let's just take it, like, I don't know, maybe 48 hours. Why? Then they go and find the lieutenant and go, we got some tape. He's on it.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Brilliant. Good work. I mean, the robbery happened today, guys, you know? Like, how long does it take to sort this robbery out? I mean...
And they know it's him the whole time, in spite of his disguise.
Yeah, but they don't know how he could do it without an accomplice. And also, the accomplice has dobbed him in as well. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but they kind of just go, so these detectives are on to John, and they're going to come to the house that Warwick's in. Oh, no, but, oh, what's this? Oh, hello, guys, I'm the lieutenant. I'm going to use my gruff voice now. What? Warwick's a lieutenant in the police force?
Also, no.
It is just a bizarre, like, twist that doesn't really make any sense, but they roll with it.
It goes from being, like, crazy dark comedy to, like, police procedural.
Yeah. And,
like...
Oh, the quicker we get to the end bit with the Polaroid, the better. So, forgive me if I'm tamping a little bit.
Well, all that really happens from here on is people drive around a lot.
Yeah.
And also, talk. John, we don't have much of a reveal where John thanks his lucky stars that he isn't hit.
Twigs of his...
Yeah.
Yeah, he discovers all his injuries and makeup, and he kind of goes, okay.
Slowly walks away from the house and not try, you know, surely he should be going on the run or wanting revenge or, you know, just trying to get the police again still.
He hunts down his girlfriend surprisingly efficiently considering what he's just been through.
Yeah, so his story now is, how does he get suspicious that his girlfriend has been...
He figured it out from what he heard on the radio. That's why he went nuts initially.
Yeah, because it's weird that his accomplice... Like, it's weird that he's got that much... He's known to have done the crime, even though he's in a disguise. Like, he shouldn't be this fast that he's getting caught, really.
And she was, like, the only one who could have known.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So he's piecing together that by phoning up car rental companies. It becomes just this weird, like, what's going on? We care about catalogs and who ought... We don't care about phone books and who rented a car.
The thing is, they could have cut that whole thing out and just had her making her escape and then he's there. And, you know, you would leave the audience with the question of how did he find her? But who cares? I don't want to watch him stick a bunch of quarters into a payphone and wander around a rental car lot going, is my car booked at 9 o'clock? And she goes, yeah. And he goes, okay.
Like, I don't even understand how that proved anything. Does anyone understand that?
No, because he'd already booked it.
But the thing, he went to check to see if the reservation was still there, and it was. Which meant that she hadn't taken the car yet, but then he twigged that's if she takes the car we already booked. So then he rang the other rental places to find out if she'd made the rental anywhere else, and she had.
Okay. I don't. Because the idea is, the money is stashed, she can pick it up, and they'd go running off into the sunset in their rental car, off, I guess, into the sunset together. But because there's been a change of plans with the renting of cars, she's obviously planning to betray him or something.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know that I could have twigged it that way. I think I would have just tried to find her at her apartment or whatever.
Yeah.
And question her about it. Or when gauge her reaction to him being there, even though he should have been arrested by now, maybe? Like, it seems very cocky of her to assume he'd instantly be arrested and that she'll be fine and get away with it. I just think she could have just ran off without betraying him, really. Like, all it took, really, is for him to drive off with her. As soon as they get to a motel on the way to Mexico or wherever they're going, she'll get up really early in the morning and drive off in the car. Wouldn't that have done? Couldn't that have been a simpler way than betraying him instantly and risking your own money and getting caught? Oh,
then we wouldn't have all these thrilling twists and turns.
You're right. I wasn't thinking like a film writer. Woe's me. Where were we? We were trying to get to the conclusion, right?
So was the film.
Yeah. So Warwick has gone with his detectives to look into the crime.
And his imaginary detectives still in the back of the car with him, despite the fact that he took medication earlier and they suggested that made them go away for the day.
No, but they said that... They said, you know, you're supposed to take two of those, aren't you?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that, but his imaginary friends said that, so how reliable are they? Like, yeah. I don't know if you could take the word of an imaginary person.
I'm not entirely sure psychiatric medication works quite that way. I don't think it's like Drop Dead Fred.
Well, for whatever reason, he sees them occasionally. We get to see that he's still imagining them occasionally on his regular day job. Or we presume it's his regular day job. Or is he just imagining he's a lieutenant? Like, how I can't believe anything.
There was something weird. Normally, I wouldn't bring this up to the very end, obviously. But I will bring it up now because of the way you put that. At the very end, when Warwick's walking down the street, it reminded me of Verbal Kint. At the end of The Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
So I was a bit like, did he just make everything up? Have I just watched everything inside Warwick's head?
Yeah.
I think that would be too similar to The Usual Suspects. But the way they play it is as if he's just a mental guy who's been functioning as a lieutenant for ages and has enough spare time to have imaginary dinner parties and stuff. I think that's what we take away from it. But we get there because they track down where the woman would be. Like, the detectives have twigged enough information to follow up on the crime. And also Warwick knows enough about it now. Like, I don't really get how the detectives know to look in the car park or wherever they go.
Or how they find her in the car park. Because they happen to find her just as John makes his run for it. And
they followed her.
They did? Oh, okay.
They followed her to the parking lot where she switched to another car.
Yeah.
And they're going to try and make the arrest. And meanwhile, John has turned up now.
Mm.
And which one of them has the money in the bag?
She does.
She did, but then he took it.
And just before the cops get there, he kind of confronts her, goes, "Aha, you lied. Why did you lie? Don't keep lying in front of me. You pretended to be ill. You are the baddie in this film. I'm taking the money in the car. You are not nice."
That was very accurate.
Yeah, because all along she was the biggest villain, not Warwick or John, because we don't even know who she is, other than she also has a party and doesn't like playing chess in the bath.
We also don't know still whether Warwick has actually ever killed anyone or what is actually going on anymore.
Yeah, but for whatever reason, the woman is arrested without the money. John is stopped then by Warwick as he's just about to leave the car park. How dramatic. Because Warwick has split up and has gone. He seems to know where John is going to be somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of serendipitous. But in the booth before they leave the car park, Warwick is hidden there and stops John in the car and is like, "Smug reveal. It is I again." Like, at that point, I'd be like, I'm never going to escape this insane man. He literally found me when he couldn't possibly have.
And he takes the money and it's like, he seems very rich and he seems very happy. What does he want all that money for?
Maybe that's how he got rich.
Robbing after torturing them. And so Warwick takes the money from the car, gives him enough money to bribe the Mexican border. Like, I don't know how that's going to work. I don't know how you subtly go, "I need to cross the Mexican border. How does
George Washington bribe his way?"
Yeah. I don't know how people bribe themselves over borders, quite frankly, because I'm sure they, have measures to stop that. But whatever, a bundle of money explains how you escape. He gives him a very small amount of the huge sack of cash. And it's just kind of, "Well, it was nice playing dinner party with you, John." Go.
Then he goes to Mexico. That's kind of it.
Apart from, he sends back a photograph to the...
one of the detectives.
Yeah. Of him and Warwick that he stole while he was still under Warwick's...
Because Warwick, being an idiot, apparently, took a picture of himself with his victim.
His pretend victims or victims, yeah.
And which he hasn't done so far. Like, in the scrapbook of whether they're victims or not, you don't see any pictures of him with them. So why he did that?
Yeah, okay, like, yeah, it is mostly the victims with what are supposed to be other people, but they've been drawn in.
Yeah.
And in the scenes we see in this dinner party, we do see Warwick making a deal of, oh, it's this time we need to take another picture for the album, and it's just things like John dealing with that and being like, oh, Warwick, can I join the conga instead?
Yeah.
Maybe if I play along? Okay, but you have to drink the weird blue stuff, and I tricked you. Let's do a conga with me holding you up. Ba, ba, ba. It's just, and he messes with him, and it's like, right, we need another picture again. And it's just constant mess with, take a picture, mess with, take a picture.
Yeah.
And it just feels like amassing evidence against yourself.
Yeah.
Luckily, but, he did.
Yeah, but then it kind of does a gotcha ending. But
as well,
yeah. it plays it out too long.
But Abby, you have a problem with the ending, in particular the cop who's got the photograph and has done.
He has he has a singular piece of evidence. He has absolutely nothing else.
And the testimony of the neighbour.
To suggest that his peace captain is corrupt and lying.
Yeah.
He keeps giving it to him. look at this. Let me hand this across the desk to you. I seem to have torn it in two. But no, Warwick gives it back. And then he gives it to him again.
He does. He really wants the one important piece of evidence to not be, like, you know, he just gives every chance to Warwick to just go, oh, is this the only copy you have? no. It is, isn't it? And you gave it to me.
Like, when he says Photoshop, and the guy says, well, no, it's a Polaroid. It's on the film. You can't Photoshop it. If he knows that much, he could just arrest him.
Yeah.
There and then.
That's why this very last bit wrecks me beyond everything else.
Yeah.
Just the incompetence of that cop.
But yeah.
It's all to set up the awkward, I have nothing, even though I'm clearly lying and I'm doing a terrible job of covering my tracks, you can't prove anything or I'll fire you. I'm going to check your house. Yes, check my house.
Yeah.
To a dinner party where you can prove I'm a criminal.
by participating in one of my dinner parties.
I don't know about you guys, but when I'm at a dinner party, I would consider it rude to turn up and then look around that person's house. Not in a come dine with me way, but in a looking for corpses and proof of murder way. I would consider that just a smidge on the rude side. I mean, sometimes you might bring a cheap wine, but I think trying to prove someone's a criminal while they offer you chips and dip, that's harsh. You can't do that in that environment. Maybe you should just call round and check while Warwick's arrested or some. What's the procedure with that? Surely it isn't talk to the guy directly, isn't it?
It isn't go around his house and get drunk. I don't know. That's.
Yeah, so Warwick offers him the choice of wine. He picks red. Red just happens to be the same wine, although he could presumably spike other colours of wine. The other colour of wine, I guess, is a blue. Although there was blue drink. You could have picked blue drink. I just would have liked just something else. Oh, I don't drink wine. Oh, do you like pina coladas? No, I just don't drink.
Yeah, I'm an ex-alcoholic. I don't.
I don't drink anything. I bring my own water. Damn it. Do you like salsa? Maybe I can spike salsa.
I'm also going to bring loads of police because we're investigating your house.
Yeah. All going to come to your dinner party and arrest you. But it is to give that ending of, ha ha ha, Warwick's going to, you know, have an imaginary dinner party with him.
And but is he going to do the same thing? Is he going to tie him up, put makeup cuts on him, and then put him in the bin outside?
Because then I think they will definitely have some evidence there.
Yeah.
Just the neighbour going, oh, what's going on in the pool? Oh, it's my friend, he's drunk again. God, you have a lot of drunk friends in ridiculous masks, don't you? Like, I've already called the police on you once for having a guy turn up in the bins. Looking like a corpse, so this can't go on. Maybe if he does it enough, he'll have enough people to actually have a dinner party with.
Yeah.
Neighbour, have her around, tie them all up. He won't have to imagine anymore.
I just thought of the sweetest little thing. How Warwick would obviously get tortured something awful if he actually went to prison. But there is part of me that thinks he'll just have this little Mad Hatter type dinner party every day with all the other actual prisoners.
In a way, it would have made sense for him to go to prison himself for being like a... Like, if the guy had just been... If Warwick had been a serial killer and the guy escapes, and we, even though he's a bank robber, we feel sorry for him because he was manipulated or whatever. And by the end, Warwick's the villain. But Warwick's in jail and he's still having... Like you say, having a dinner party with all the convicts. And he's a psycho still and a nutjob, but he's still happy and dining. But we know
still the perfect host.
But you know, that's what happened, guys. I mean, I was left baffled and amused. How were you guys feeling at the end of the film?
It was going really well. I was really enjoying like the first third of the film, and then the second third of the film got quite interesting, and I was enjoying that. And then the film just seems to have concussed itself in the last third and doesn't really know what it is or what's going on and just leaves so many loose questions in the air, which is such a shame because the rest of it is really sinister and the performances from the main two people are really good and very watchable. It's just such... a shame, right at the end, it ruins it by trying to be a different film altogether.
I like the fact that it blew my mind, because I would have never guessed the third act, because being film literate, I expected something more, not contrite, but more predictable and sort of, wanted a feel-good ending where you kind of are surprised, but also you get the whole reveal and it's like, oh, brilliant, but it wasn't. It was just, I could never have guessed he would be a lieutenant in the police force and know about the crime and... It was just, what? So it was surprising.
Yeah, in a sense, it's almost admirably insane in the way it takes the story. Because it does leave you going, what? But it also doesn't bear being analysed or thought about too much because it all falls apart.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no underpinning logic to a lot of it.
When I finished watching this movie, it was very much... If I hadn't have enjoyed David Hyde Pierce as much as I did, I would have called this the biggest piece of rubbish I'd ever seen. But I did.
It's really frustrating. And the frustrating thing is, like Anthony said, the first two thirds are so good.
Yeah.
And it's such a strong premise just by itself. The idea of someone being held hostage at a crazy man's dinner party, that is fine. That is a film in and of itself.
Mm.
And there's just this weird tacked-on third act where there's all this, like, and all the plot is shoved in at the end. It didn't need that much of a plot. It just needed the premise and then the performances, which were great. And, you know, I don't know what they were thinking.
Yeah, John and Warwick were two interesting characters that we could have seen, going through different relationships where it's tense and it's all about lies and con stuff, and then it's about, like, oh, this guy's crazy, and then a kind of the ending that's a bit more like something like a film like Sleuth, where they've been battling wits all night and we don't know who to be the biggest villain, and then someone gets an upcomings, but do they really? Like, it should have been a bit more traditional and calmed itself down.
Yeah, it could have, like, it's such an unusual premise that it could have played by a few rules.
Yeah, and which is bizarre. We usually were like, nah, throw out the rule book.
Yeah, but you can tell, because this is based on a short film that the director had made earlier, like 2001, and I can imagine how good that short film probably was, that it was good enough to warrant a bigger version. But it's like he took the short film and then went, oh, I don't know how to make it longer, so made up something else to shove it at the end.
Yeah. There are just too many problems with Warwick having this complicated a situation that he... It's just too much. It's like you can't be a lieutenant and have an imaginary life and have previous victims that you don't kill. Like, there's too many things that...
But that's the thing, though. Did he kill them? I had no idea. And where
but he had a makeup box to imply
why?
He did makeup on everyone he ever...
But then if he didn't kill them, surely one of them would have come forward saying, this guy was really strange to me last night.
There are loads of loose ends out there that just woke up and were glad enough to be free, so they didn't say anything. Or maybe they thought they imagined it.
Like, yeah, and why does he have the makeup box, and how is he such a good makeup artist?
I don't know, but I think we could have come up... I think we could have come up with better endings to what was a really funny and interesting idea. Like, loads of the things we've talked about would have worked. And I don't think it's just because we came up with them, we would have liked it. But I genuinely think there were better solutions than, he's a lieutenant and he has a weird life that you can't explain. but hey, guys, it was quite the performance. And we saw so much of David Hyde Pierce larking about, imagining people, and holding up in a sort of Weekend at Bernie's way a poor victim and making him join in. That, surely, is enough to say, check the film out.
Yeah, I don't know if I would, like, recommend it necessarily, but I would say it's worth watching just to see David Hyde Pierce do something really different and really dark really well. Mm. And even though the ending chunk where he becomes a policeman was frustrating and didn't make any sense, I still liked him in it. I liked how different he was then to how he had been throughout the film.
Yeah.
So, are we cautiously recommending it? Does anyone have any sort of rating you would put? Like, is The Perfect Host, how is it rated on Imaginary Friends? Is it rated on...
You could do, like, food.
We can give it... We could, because of its link to Come Dine With Me, we can give it a number and say what we thought could be improved. We've kind of said that already.
That's just a rating
system. Here we go. Yeah. But it's still slightly mad, like the film.
But you have to do it the way they do it.
Yeah, so,
for example, I would give it, like, the starter was quite well.
Yeah, there you go.
The main course was served quite well, but however, it let it down in the dessert.
Yeah.
So I give it a 6.
That's exactly what I was implying. That's where I was going, and Anthony picked up that ball really well. Thank you. I guess we'd all say that, though. It's like, I love the starter. Oh, it was so fresh and interesting. And then the whole main course just counteracted the zingy taste of the sorbet and was through starting sorbet. Like, but that's it. That's the thing, isn't it? But the finishing thing was just disgusting and abhorrent.
The only thing I can think of to describe it, I have to describe by you rather than myself, because I can't think of an appropriate food. It's like they gave you a starter, a main course, and a dessert of Jaffa Cakes. It doesn't make any sense as a three-course meal. It's all Jaffa Cakes, you don't care.
I guess. If someone gave
I don't like Jaffa Cakes, so...
Jaffa Cake soup would be a bit horrible, though. And then, like, a Jaffa Cake main would be wrong. And then a Jaffa Cake finish would be okay. Like, I don't know, it very much was nearly a lovely evening out. We were all being entertained thoroughly, and then right at the end it went to pot and the host nearly stabbed us with a fork. It is a bizarre film. I am glad I watched it, but it, like Anthony held up the 6, I'm going to hold up a 6 as well. Do you guys have a number to hold up in the back of the taxi, like in Come Dine With Me, and any final comments?
I'm gonna lowball it. I'm gonna, like, hold up a 5.
But next week, The Perfect Host gets to judge you for your film. So remember that. You can't vote tactically and Come Dine With Me.
I'm holding up a 7 because I laughed fairly consistently, which is hard. So they did enough right.
Because sometimes, in Come Dine With Me, it's not that it doesn't matter that the meal wasn't good. The atmosphere was perfect. We had a wonderful evening. Yeah. And it doesn't matter that the dessert was a disgusting mess. / the end of the movie. We all had a lovely time.
Okay.
So, I don't know what that means for next week's spoiler-filled film conversation and how that film will score in the Come Dine With Me rating system. And how will The Perfect Host vote for us? We have no idea, because the metaphor ends there, doesn't it? Just as the podcast should. So, we should say our goodbyes.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah, we just slammed the abrupt ending on you. Eat that. But you're not hearing this because I've edited it out. Ooh, meta.
I thought of a different metaphor.
Oh, well, maybe we put it in. Go on.
It's just when you've had you've had a fairly good meal, you were fairly content, and then suddenly right at the end, the hostess takes out, like, a ukulele or a guitar, suddenly expects you to sing Kumbaya.
It is somebody what? Busting out a guitar at a party, isn't it?
It's a bit of Christian karaoke right at the end. And it's just, wow, you have buzzkilled everything. I think that's apt. I think that's a good way to sum it up, to be honest. So maybe that'll go in. We'll see.